Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to wellness professionals ready to assist, inform and inspire. Today we're looking at how men determine their worth and what to do when things go wrong. My guest is Neil Bierbaum, Mindset Coach for Leaders and High-Performing Teams, speaking from Johannesburg. Welcome, Neil.
Hi, Mariëtte. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very interested to hear what you're going to say. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. After our conversation, it will be fun question time. Neil, could you provide us with an overview of the work you do?
Yeah, sure. So my main occupation is as a leadership and executive and team performance coach, as you said. And so that's working one-on-one with leaders in the corporate environment, as well as with teams, getting teams to move from places of stuckness into high performance. And a lot of it is around mindset, as you mentioned, you know, and the key mindset being a curiosity mindset. And so whether it's leadership or improving team performance, I find that curiosity is at the core of that. So that's the main thing. And then as a life coach, I do quite a lot of work as a life coach with men in particular. And more recently, I've moved into the content creation side. So I began my career as a journalist because I had a passion for writing, and I wrote because I wanted to understand people and life. And along that journey, I think I realized at some point I didn't know enough about that. And that's what set me on the coaching journey. I went in search of greater understanding, I guess you could say, and that's where I discovered coaching. And so I've been coaching for 20 years now, and I feel like I'm at a point where I kind of know that I know what I'm doing. And so I'm looking to put that back, you know, bringing that back together with the writing. I've written it into a couple of books, website programs, and so on. And I have a newsletter on Substack called The Mindset, as well as a YouTube channel. And so I'm quite active in putting my content out there. And I'm hoping that that can lead to something, you know, in terms of bringing audience to the programs, online programs that I've created, and, you know, and generally making a contribution through that content.
Yes. And today, the listeners and I will get a peek into one of the topics you're interested in.
Absolutely.
So, Neil, I came across a recent video of yours on your YouTube channel called The Mindset Channel. And in it, you explained that men are biologically set up to want to achieve more than women are. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I think it's important to preface that this is a view that links gender with biological sex. And I think I got hammered for that on LinkedIn because, you know, some of the views that people have on that. However, I do believe it remains valid to speak in terms of traditional gender norms, especially for a more mature audience. And that while there are more progressive views out there, they are very recent. And there's thousands of years of biology and social norms behind that. So, yes, I recognize that this can be challenged. And my claim was based on the work of neurobiologist and author Michael Gurian, and this was back in the early 2000s, I think. He wrote the book, What Could He Be Thinking? And he mentioned or put forward the idea that there's a biological tendency in men to seek self-worth through personal independent performance whereas women have a greater tendency to experience worth through relationships and intimacy. And the link for that is that women are able to gestate and a life within them and give birth. And there's an immense, incredible, profound connection that happens there that men can never have or even begin to understand. Kind of all a man can do is donate his sperm, and after that, what? You know, and until recently, we weren't even there for the birth. And, you know, and then women continue to provide food for the child from their body. So the connection, and you can see it in the way that a mother regards her child versus the way that a father regards their child. I still remember one instance when my son was playing ice hockey. For some reason, he chose that as a sport. And he was playing for the provincial team for Gauteng against Western Province. And they got hammered. And my now ex-wife and I were both sitting at the same place in the stands. Both took a picture and both posted on Facebook. And she said, "Well done, team. Such a wonderful performance." And I was like, you know, they learned a good lesson there, you know, and you can just see the different approaches that mothers and fathers take. And yeah, so the thing is that with that, for men to feel that connection to, according to this idea, what they need to, well, what can they do? They can hunt and provide and protect. And so that is strongly embedded in the masculine idea of themselves, of ourselves. And I think in the modern era, that comes down to the way that achievement matters to men. So for a woman, I would say it's part of who they are. Their sense of achievement is a part of who they are. For men, very often it is who they are. And there are studies that have shown that mortality rates for men spike in the range of 2 to 5 years after retiring. And in line with this argument, I would ask the question, could it be that they lose their worth and have nothing left to live for? That is one of the possibilities.
Yes, and that's one reason why I invited you today, because that question really intrigues me. Now, Neil, could you offer some examples of men who show what you have just talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where, you know, it was reflecting on those that led to the piece that I wrote. I was once called in to see if I could help somebody. It was the brother of a client. And I found this guy. He was probably in his early 60s. And he was literally sitting in the chair, just rocking back and forth, saying, "I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have done it." He was almost catatonic. Like, you could not get through to him. And what he was pointing to was the fact that he had been a very successful founder and director, shareholder and director of a big insurance company in South Africa. And then he'd gone to Australia and tried to do the same thing, and it didn't work, which many people experience going to new countries. And he came back, and it wasn't just like his tail between his legs, but in this kind of a state. And the fact is that he was still worth what most of us would consider a lot of money, probably in the tens of millions. So he was able to live on that. But he hadn't been the champion who had kind of won the race and, you know, topped out or exited, as we say, from the company, or, you know, made the hundreds of millions or billions that would have satisfied his sense of worth or sense of identity. And that was the key thing, was, you know, how strongly identified we can be with something like a number or an idea of our worth being based on an abstract achievement. Because on one level, you'd look at him and say, well, he was fine, but it wasn't enough for him. And it was about the number and the value. I've seen in other instances too where, say, somebody was a big shot, a doctor in his hometown, and then he retires and moves, or semi-retires, moves to a small town in another province to be close to children and grandchildren. And then without the recognition, and because he's kind of new, so he wasn't getting the you know, he wasn't the famous doctor in this town anymore. And he suffered an enormous identity crisis as a result of that, and had to go through, you know, therapy, came for coaching, and eventually recovered. But, you know, it was that loss of identity. And then I've also seen it in younger men. There was one guy I coached who was still in his 20s, late 20s, who had done enormously well in the trading, share trading and investment space. And his idea was that he had to have 100 million rand in assets before he could ask a woman to marry him. And so, again, it keeps pointing to this number, like there's a number and monetary value that defines our worth, or some men's worth.
Mm. Now, Neil, there are people who argue that these things are the same for men and women, and that gender identity should not be linked to one's biological sex assigned at birth. What would you say to that?
Yeah, absolutely. The, you know, that's is the modern or the social constructionist viewpoint, that gender is entirely a social construct and not linked at all to biology. That's the foundation of what we'd call woke thinking or gender ideology. I'm always amazed at how emotional and reactive that argument becomes, even though both sides insist that their claims are based on science. So there's a kind of irony in that. But it also shows that there's a lot hinging on these ideas. And I, in my view, I think we need to address that, the emotional response, if we're going to get somewhere with the debate. And I really believe it's a both and or a not an either or answer. You know, I talk about a curiosity mindset. It's like keeping an open and curious mind about it. Because there certainly are gender roles that are learned or handed to us that are not useful, like men dominating the academic and leadership field. I mean, I somehow doubt that Russia would have invaded Ukraine if it had a female president.
Mm.
But then their spy technology would probably be second to none, or so it would be that. Ha-ha. Just a joke. Something like someone's physical strength. I mean, I grew up, yes, I was encouraged in that area, but also, you know, I was fortunate. I had that as a capacity. So by the time I was 17, I was playing rugby and I could do 200 kgs leg press and 100 kgs bench press, you know, sets of that. And I could easily, say, strip a bolt on a, if I was tightening it, or even younger, I remember my parents saying, you don't know your own strength. So you had to limit that strength. And that became a part of my identity. So it's very hard to imagine, if you have that, that is not, you know, doesn't affect your sense of self, and that it links into your, because that is a very masculine capability. So, yeah, I think there's validity on both sides of the argument, and I think we need to find that common ground. And a lot of that is just about managing ourselves rather than just reaching for the next piece of evidence to back up our own argument.
Yeah. Curiosity, as you said. Then men are sometimes criticized for their need to achieve and be recognized and for basing their worth on a monetary value, as in the examples you gave. To people who may say that it points to a fragile ego, how would you respond?
I think there's probably some validity in that. It's fair. And I think that with that criticism ought to come some compassion. So, you know, it might turn out differently for the latest generation, but most men, my generation, didn't have the guidance or perspective that some men, you know, some men today are getting. I mean, there was an incident of bullying at my old school, which is one of the sort of big traditional schools, and it was recently reported in the papers, or I think it's about to come out or something. It was on the old boys group, I saw it, and the outcome was that both boys got counseling. And we didn't have that. I never had any of that going on. And sure, girls didn't, but girls tend to talk about their emotions and process stuff more naturally. Boys don't, or men don't. We suffer alone and in silence. I know the Jungian analyst and author James Hollis, who I'm a big fan of, calls it a conspiracy of silence. And I've seen this happen in men's groups. So typically in men's groups, when the men get introduced, they do this thing where they do a round and they say, okay, tell us your story. And then everyone will give like the, you know, I'm this and I'm that and I've got this business and, you know, and give the impressive sales spiel. And then they'll do, okay, let's do a round of, you know, tell the deepest story, the next level, or a deeper truth, they call it. And that's when everything comes out and every single guy has something going on. You know, my child is on drugs, or I've lost, you know, my business is failing, or, you know, there's something. And by the time you've done that, everybody realizes that they're not alone. And I do this in teams as well. You get people who work together in teams, all genders, and, you know, who putting their best side forward in the professional environment. And when they get to that deeper truth, they suddenly become human to each other. So yes, it happens in both, but particularly men seem to struggle with that, you know, being able to put that truth forward and be vulnerable. And so, yeah, I think that they need support and they need help with that. We need support and we need help with that.
Yeah, this is so important if one looks at the at how important vulnerability is to create intimacy.
Absolutely.
I'd like us to discuss what men can do when they are unable to determine their worth in the way that speaks to them. But before we do that, could we look at the four stages of maturity? On your website, The Man Matrix, you refer to four stages of maturity. What are they, Neil?
Yeah, that's something that I've that has evolved through my experience and reading. I think on this topic, I've read and explored a lot, and through my own experience, and it's based on the work of partly of Robert Bly, who is wrote the book Iron John and is a leader of what's called the men's mythopoetic movement. So the Mankind Project is very much based on his work. And then also the work of Carl Jung. And so Bly identified these three stages, which was each given a color, and it came out of mythological interpretations. And there's the red, gray, and black. No, sorry, red, white, and black. And then Jung talked about the four stages of the development of the animus, which is the female, the male aspect of the female psyche. And there were four stages. And I looked at it and I thought, well, the black stage of Bly is actually needs to be separated out because we have what we call the midlife crisis in our modern world. And so I broke it down into these four stages, and that's where that comes from. Basically, there's the four stages that are from 16 to 25, and the theme of that is rebellion, and we give that the color red. Then from 26 to 35, we get to the theme is compliance, and the color is white. And then from 36 to 55 is integration, which we give the color gray. And from 56 onwards, the theme is wisdom, which we would give the color black to. So to describe what and why, so in that first stage, 2016 to 25, you know, if anybody has a teenage son, they'll know that if you try and tell them what to do, they will rebel. And that's because they're trying to establish their own identity and separate themselves out. And meanwhile, we're trying to draw them in and become useful members of society, but they're trying to establish themselves and rebel and create their own identity. And so there's this tension, and they tend to be full of testosterone and anger. And so we, in the traditional, in the old days, we would initiate them. We would put them through an initiation. We'd send them to be soldiers or sailors and, you know, put them to use outside the village where they could burn up all that energy. And we wouldn't let our daughters marry them at that age. So it's a very, you know, and we see it in boys today, you know, wanting to rebel. But in today's society, we kind of look at that and go, well, you know, because of the modern interpretation that all behavior is learned, we see that red behavior. And instead of thinking it's archetypal and we need to let them find a constructive way to express it, one way would be like, say, playing rugby, but we don't always encourage that either. So then we think, well, it must be conditioned, so we must try and condition it out of them and look for where this comes from. So we suppress that. And then that's when you get an angry reaction, like, you know, Jung would say that doesn't go anywhere, that energy gets projected outwards. So if you look online on YouTube, I think in one month, last month, in terms of search terms around masculinity, the search for Andrew Tate got searched 7 million times, twice as high as the next highest thing, which was Jordan Peterson, and then, you know, various other terms as well. So you can see that that's where the anger is going. And so that's the red stage. Let me not go into it for too long. I could talk all day about it. Then what happens is during that stage, we'll also be educated and cultured and, you know, become cultured. And most of it's for the reasons traditionally of wooing a woman and having a, you know, getting married, having a family. Usually by the time you're into your 20s, late 20s and into your 30s, you're starting to you know, you've qualified, you're starting to get a job, you're probably moving to your first management position, you might be getting married, having children. So now you've become a upstanding member of society and you want to uphold the laws. That's why I say it's a phase of compliance. And you become, like Robert Bly said, that white knight who's charging in there trying to help and fix everything. And so that becomes that stage. And that's where we can become quite rigid. And you see a lot of that around. And, you know, people fighting for, whether they're liberal or conservative, they're very right and very white and very moralistic and, you know, having all the answers kind of thing. And upholding and sustaining a good society becomes important to them, which is opposite from the rebelling of the red. And then we move into the midlife, which is the gray. And that's when, you know, whatever strategy was working for you in your 30s starts to fail. You start getting feedback and you start realizing there's more to life. And so then it becomes about integrating those shadow parts, as Jung said. That's why it's the phase of integration. And we don't always do that successfully. We can go into that more detail if there's time. But if we do go through that successfully, often it's about accepting loss, accepting limitation, and then that helps us to move to the stage of black, which is wisdom. And wisdom is very much, very often the opposite of white almost. You know, it's given the color black. So an example of wisdom would be, say, Robert Bly tells a story of Abraham Lincoln, and a woman comes and knocks on his door urgently. Her son has been caught sleeping on guard duty during the Civil War, and he's about to be executed by a firing squad. And if the guy was in white, he would have said, well, those are the rules. We must stick to them. We can't treat anybody differently. But because Lincoln was in black, wisdom, compassion, and he looked at it and he said, well, that wouldn't make much sense. He wouldn't do too much use for us dead. And so he pardoned the guy. Nelson Mandela would be an example of somebody who reached black and was able to, say, allow the Springboks emblem to be used, where someone in white would have gone, no, that would be against the rules or not acceptable. So that's an example. And not all men get to that. I think in our leadership world at the moment, we lack that. Some men get stuck. Like if you look at some of the world leaders who are stuck in red, so they're all about expansion and conquer and that kind of thing. Those are like guys who've never resolved their stuff, and they're still like boys stuck in red, but with all the power of a mature man. I think we're lacking a lot of the black in our leadership today. So those are my four stages.
That is such a succinct explanation. Thank you. It's triggering many thoughts in my head.
I think it's useful and practical, and people, whenever I share it with people of whether male or female, it really helps to put things in perspective, and it links into deep archetypes. So it's not about the conditioning and that kind of thinking. It really taps into some archetypes, and it makes a lot of sense, and it's a workable model. So, yeah.
Neil, from the examples you quoted earlier, it seems that in terms of feeling worthy as a man, things can go wrong in any phase of maturity.
Yes, absolutely. Although it's probably less obvious when you're young. So when you're young and you're red or even white, you tend to believe your own BS, so you're less likely to listen and learn. I think you need to know what to look for to see it in young men when they're not on a good path. And mostly it's, you know, in the red, when they carry that through and they're dreamers and have unrealistic ideals. Of course, all men are dreamers or idealists in some way, but the test is how grounded they are with that. So if a young guy has big ideas, but he still follows through with things, completes things, stays the course when things get tough, stuff like that, then he's probably going to be okay. It's when they don't commit, give up too soon, or think they're somehow special, they're going to be the next Steve Jobs or Elon Musk, just you wait and see, or they keep working for that big windfall. So looking for the easy route or the big deal. I always say to guys, you know, the big deals are vanity. Cash flow is sanity. That's, you know, you've got to pay the rent first. Or these days, people always look for the exit. See, they want to do a startup. Like this is the thing on YouTube. You'll see a lot of people are following people who've had a successful exit, like a seven-figure exit. So they've sold their company for $1 billion or something, and then they're going to teach you how to do it. There's a huge fascination with trying to get that. And obsessions with that, rather than walking the plane of the earth, are things to look out for. So those are the ones who need help, I would say. Yeah, then the thing is, what happens in the first part of life, you get given chances based on your potential. People will give you a chance. But kind of by your mid-30s and into your 40s, people are starting to look, be more interested in your track record. What have you done with all those chances you were given? Have you demonstrated character and overcome hardships and stuck it out when things got tough? Or did you just bounce from one option to the next? And those are the key things. So the ones who keep chasing glory and not building a track record, they're the ones who often get into trouble and life becomes very hard for them. Because they suddenly realize, you know, they've been talking a big game and there's nowhere left to hide. And, you know, then their ego, it's very difficult for you to go back and say, okay, that was a mistake, I need to start again. They tend to just get bigger and bigger stories until eventually they, yeah, become like a massive swindler or get into some serious trouble. I would say that Brett Kebble was an example of that. You know, where the story got so big and eventually it just couldn't contain itself.
Do you find that men's quest for meaning spikes during the midlife crisis? And what is going on for men at that stage?
Yeah, absolutely. Often men come to coaching and I can tell by the questions they're asking, as you know, where they are, and in their mid to late 30s, they start to ask particular questions. And I would call it a midlife transition. There's a healthy and an unhealthy way to approach it. If you approach it in the unhealthy way, it becomes a kind of a crisis. Mm-hmm. And what happens, in my view, is, as I said, in the beginning, we start out, we have a certain strategy for life. So we develop it based on who we are, but also in reaction to our environment. So some guys will become very command and control in their approach. Other people will feel that a more diplomatic approach and being nice to everybody is more important. And we develop this unconscious strategy, and it kind of works for us in the outward journey, or those first two stages, the red and the white. But somewhere when we're getting into our mid-30s, we're starting to get feedback from the world. So our family will be telling us stuff. Our boss, you know, at work, we get feedback, 360 reviews or performance reviews from our boss, and just general stuff, you know, things that are working and not working. And somewhere in our mind, there's something telling us like that strategy isn't working anymore, or it's not necessary anymore. I developed it for an earlier stage of my life, but now it's not relevant. Now, the key that happens here is whether a man recognizes and accepts that or not. So what will happen is eventually that strategy will catch up to you. You'll be command and control one too many times and destroy a relationship, or too many relationships, or someone will lose their job because they're just too aggressive, or someone who's too nice and diplomatic will, you know, lose out on opportunities and people get frustrated with them. And then do they take that lesson and say, okay, I need to change, I need to adapt? Because often the male psyche will see that as a loss, like a failure, and they don't want to do that. So often I'll get guys coming to me in midlife and they'll say, I want to go back, meaning they want to go back to how they were, but they're not recognizing that going back, that's the guy who got you where you are now. So if you go back there, you're just going to get to where you are now again. And the key there is to recognize that they have to go forward, they have to integrate. And that loss is what Jung would call integrating the shadow. It's opening up to new possibilities. It's recognizing that I'm not always right, that there are other ways of doing things, that I don't always have to win, that I don't have to get my way, and that's not a loss of power. And that whole journey. So if a guy opens up and goes on that journey, then he can integrate and have a successful transition. But if he doesn't, he wants to go back, that's when it becomes a crisis. And then he doubles down. He'll go harder, faster, louder, just, you know, do it again with a younger wife and a bigger car and a whatever. And then it'll come back again in his 60s and probably, you know, hit him again. So Yeah, so that's my view of what happens in that stage and what's going on for men when they hit that midlife transition and what we need to do.
Being in my 60s, Neil, I see many men who have a hard time redefining their identity when they retire or when they can't work. Sometimes it's due to illness or other limitations or whatever. What would you advise men who feel that their worth has diminished?
Yeah, it's a very important question. And I guess, you know, for me, I'm going to use some unusual language here. It's kind of coaching language, so stay with me. We find purpose and motivation by serving a context. So the phrase serving a context. So a job or a family or being on the school governing body, those are all contexts. And mostly they hand it to you. So you have to get a job. And then when you get a job, it's got a very defined context. So it tells you what time you got to get up, what you're going to wear, how you're going to behave. All of that stuff is handed to you from your context. And the more clear your context, the fewer decisions you have to make within that. You don't have to scratch around for what to do. Like on a work day, your context is very clear. Get up and get to work at 8 o'clock. On a weekend or on holiday, your context is more vague. So then you're kind of less clear about what you're going to do for the day. So this is the power of having a clear context. And mostly, as I said, that's handed to us. But when you get older and you no longer have to work or you can't work, you no longer have a defined context. Where do you find your focus, your meaning that supports you? And so the answer is, well, you have to create one. And what does that look like? So creating a meaningful context that you can serve and live into. That's the coaching language. So it's a conscious and deliberate thing. And you're no longer required to support a family or whatever. So what role can you play that would provide a context and be meaningful in some other way? So I have a client, for example, who's a grandfather who does the school run every day. He does some work and then he pursues his music hobby and publishes stuff to YouTube and then does some exercise. So he's tremendously fulfilled through that. But it's, you know, he's got these different things that he's serving. And I know someone else who acts as a chairman for the complex he lives in, retired, but that keeps him very busy. Another one is who provides handyman work to local charities. I see there's a guy who fills potholes in the streets. So there's plenty to do there. Mm-hmm. And these are just examples, but the common denominator is having a context that challenges you. And if we go into the principles of the flow state instead of optimal experience, we see that it's a similar principle there as well. So, and it doesn't even matter that much whether you enjoy it. I mean, you didn't enjoy getting to work every day, but it kept you focused and gave you meaning, which is what matters. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what I would offer. And hopefully that'll help us get some potholes filled.
Yeah. Neil, which questions could a man feeling less than ask himself?
Yeah, again, a great question. And I think there's one that I pointed to in that video that we referred to in the beginning. The main question I was putting forward is for a man to ask himself, what worth do I have apart from what I do or what I earn or what I own? And very often for someone who hasn't earned or doesn't own what he thinks, because often we will, like that guy, have a number in our mind and we never achieve that, or we compare ourselves to others and we never achieve that. So what you're really asking there is, what worth do I have without all of that? Or what worth do I have despite not having what those other guys have? And sometimes to get to the bottom of that one, if you imagine you'd lost everything and somebody was there offering to care for you, what would make you accept their care? That thing, that's the worth that you have apart from everything else, just your core humanity. So if you can get in touch with that and see that core level of self-acceptance, not because of what you've achieved, because self-acceptance is, it's not conditional, it's unconditional. So getting in touch with that and then building back up from there, from that place of acceptance of who you are, where you are right now, of the decisions you've made, the things you've done, really aligning with that, recognizing that you were doing your best, for example, and this is where you find yourself. And then building from there.
Yeah, when I think of that very interesting question, I think it can be hard to answer this kind of question. How can you guide or support a man who is facing this journey?
Yeah, to answer that in a minute, the important points about that question is it's not the kind of question that has an answer like you're going to write it down and go, okay, there, and you've given it a tick. It's a kind of a question you live into. So it's like it's a question you carry around. You keep exploring, keep asking yourself, and it becomes an exploration. It's not something that has a one-line answer or that you're ever going to write down in one sentence and then put it away in a box and you're done. Mm. So it's one to keep open. Your question, how can you support a man who's in that sort of place? I would say two things. The one is steering him away from regret and towards acceptance, as I've said. And it's that recognition that life could not have been other than it was. We always have this thing about the past that conceptually it could have been different. But if you go into it actually, you were always going to do what you were going to do. You were always going to make the decisions you were going to make. So while we can think about it in an abstract or conceptual way that it could have been different, the reality is you were always going to do what you were going to do. And when you can really see that and get that as an insight, you start to gain a level of acceptance around yourself and your life, and other things open up in that space, other possibilities, other ways of seeing things. So if you can, don't support the person going into regret, because that just gives more energy. Give it some attention, but then challenge them to create a meaningful context for themselves. What can you do that is purposeful with the time that you have left? And I mean, even for me, like I recently completed my master's. I think I had huge academic potential when I was younger, but I went on a wild, rebellious journey. I was very red and went into a very rebellious phase, and also probably didn't really have the opportunity or the financial means to study when I was younger. So doing it now, I'm 58 and I've just graduated with my master's, was one of the most incredible things to have done. And to say, okay, I did that, even though it's late in life and I've still got 20 years ahead of me where I can work and use that. But even that's not the point. I remember when I was younger, meeting someone who had studied in this and only qualified in their 50s to become a lawyer. It's still tremendously satisfying, but it doesn't have to be on that scale. It can be, something else I always did was work with furniture. I learned with my father to do carpentry and make furniture. And I've never fully explored that to the extent that I did. And recently I started making furniture. And again, it's these things that we can still do that are meaningful and, create a context for ourselves. So there are still ways that we can do that. And then the other thing I think is about, letting people explore their story and tell their story. And I think a lot of young people today reject their fathers, but they don't know their father's story. And I think if they had to go into it, like I said about those men's groups, and you sit there and you find out what's really going on for someone, exploring what dreams a person had as a young man that he was forced to give up on or that he would still like to pursue. And in what way is that possible? Even if it's not on the grand scale that you'd hoped, how could you still do it now? And I think that would be meaningful as well.
Note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life by interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. The section Up Close and Personal on my website offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients, or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart. Let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. To each listener, no matter your age, occupation, or where you live, how about creating your very own personal audio recording with me as a one-of-a-kind gift to someone you deeply care for? In this private interview with me, you can share childhood memories with your children or grandchildren. Record a bird's eye view of your career or business, or speak about an unforgettable trip. The possibilities are endless. To find out more, just click on Gift Podcasts on my website. Now, back to my guest. Do you think these suggestions you have made, do you think they could apply to any age?
Yeah. Yes. Although recognizing that this is going to come is probably more useful for younger people. But when we're young, we don't really. We kind of think we own the world. And, you know, the whole our context is it's a wide open. We've got forever. We're going to live forever. And we have all this power. And so it's kind of difficult to do that. And that's why life is, it goes the way it goes. Sometimes it's very hard to, you know, it's almost like life is set up in a strange way. We end up with the information that we needed in the beginning. That's how it is.
It's true.
And so the thing is, for young men, if they want to, if you want to not have that, you need to start doing that inner work when you're younger. So that's the thing, is to start, especially in your 40s, when those men who want to go back, I think that's the key time. That's the first time it really becomes visible. And the key then is to not want to go back in that way. I understand what guys are saying. They want to get their zest for life back or whatever, but you can't go back to being who you were. You've got to move forward and become, you know, that more integrated person. And that's really the key piece, because if you don't do it, then it's going to happen again. You'll probably run for another 15 or 20 years. But then when you're 60 and you ask to make changes, you kind of feel like, well, it's a bit late now. And it becomes much harder to do. So, yeah, I think doing the inner work as young as possible is the key.
I was intrigued by your website, The Man Matrix. Now, you've got the full stages on it, but there is much more info. Would you like to say something about that?
Yeah, for sure. There was almost a fun project in a way. It was somebody was asking me to, you know, help them understand men, and I started explaining this, and I thought, well, yeah, let me write it up, and I wrote it up and built a website out of it, because that's just kind of what I do in my spare time is play with ideas and do those creative projects. So it's got the four stages of maturity, and then it maps that against what I call levels of solidity. So you get men who are very grounded and practical, and people might get frustrated with them because they seem almost incapable of any abstract thinking. They're just so practical and grounded. And then you get guys whose heads are way up in the clouds, and then there's a range in between. So I sort of borrowed from the Enneagram, 9 styles of the Enneagram, and I ranked them according to this idea of solidity to, from being ideas down to solidity. And that has a theory behind it as well, which is around Jung's idea of the pueriternus, so the boy energy that gets drawn, which is vertical, and gets drawn into the grounded senex energy. The word senator comes from senex and is the horizontal energy. And in the old tradition, the initiation was to draw men from the vertical spirit boy energy, which was that one that is always full of ideas and running around and jumping from one thing to the next, to the Senex energy, which walks the plane of the earth and, you know, becomes useful. But too much of one and you become like that guy who's always chasing dreams, and too much of the other and you become hardened and cynical. So you need both. So that's the background to where I got this idea of the you know, men being grounded versus not. And I put it together and I created some models so you can get a report off it, and it'll, you can identify which way, where you think you are on the map, and then it'll give you a report and it'll kind of give you a sense of what those issues are that you could be facing in midlife that you might need to focus on in order to go through that integration, as one example, and how you might show up in relationships and what you can do differently. So it's, there's reports that you can download, free reports and a paid version, which is more detailed, and it's not scientifically tested, but I do think it's got a lot of relevance as a reference point for people to work with.
Yeah, very interesting. Neil, for those who want to learn more about your work or follow you, where can they go?
So my website, neilbeerbaum.com, although I do have the Mindset newsletter on Substack, and that has a section called Growing Men, which you can subscribe to separately. So you can subscribe to the whole thing or just that section. And then my YouTube channel as well, which is under my name, at Neil Beerbaum on YouTube, or the Mindset channel you can look for. So those are two places where I'm putting out stuff weekly. And yeah, people can follow me on there and get regular updates.
Thank you. I'll attach the links to the websites to the podcast, and then the rest will be in the podcast notes.
Great. Thank you.
May I ask you a fun question?
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned the designer furniture you make. I read about that, and I connected my question to that. So, Neil, if you were a tool used for this purpose, what would you be and why?
That's a very interesting question. Going through my, probably, definitely not a hammer. I would be the chisel. Crafting those fine angles and fine details, you know, out of the block of wood. So I think what I always do is I always explore the fine details. I love beauty and aesthetics, but I also love understanding things properly. And so if I'm writing, to get the language right, to be very, I think I'm very precise and specific in the way that I do things and communicate. So yes, I'm the chisel.
Thank you, Neil. And thank you for speaking with such clarity on your issues I now have a much better understanding of, and especially maybe I could call them the hidden challenges that men face, which we as their partners, you know, it really helps to have more insight into that. So thank you.
Wonderful. Yeah. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure. And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. I'd be honored if you'd subscribe to this podcast series. And if you found this episode meaningful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariet Sneeman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear, and Helpful, is produced by me, with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.